humanity is. You know, on one end of the spectrum, you have the genetic modification technologies that are growing. On the other end, you have robotics and neuro-mechanical interfaces. So, you'll have the Borg on one side, and you'll have some guy with a brain twice as big as ours and probably a lot of neck pain. So, you know, if we live long enough as a society and learn enough, we're going to be able to screw things up rather terribly given the opportunity. And, you know, some wealthy guy out there is going to want their newborn child, who they'll name XYZ Omega 4, to have a brain twice the size as most human beings.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
I'll just drop a brief bomb here. We've communicated about transhumanist ideas being absurd and ridiculous and unfounded, but you seem to be speaking of them right now. Your comments.
I mentioned the time frame. Your good friend Noah places the time frame, next Wednesday, because he can sell a lot more books if he says next Wednesday instead of 300 years from now. I tend to think it's going to be a long, drawn-out affair. There's not going to be any kind of, in my humble opinion, revolutionary discovery that's going to decode the entire genetics of life, and you'll just be able to set some parameters in a computer and it will formulate a genome. You plant it in a automated uterus, and you have a new life form next Wednesday. I don't think that's going to happen. I think a lot of these things are massive technological hurdles that will take centuries. And then the question that begs itself is, will we actually survive all those centuries? Because along with the discovery of genetic manipulation and patching machines into human beings, God knows what some people are going to try and get away with, and will we survive it? So I have a lot of questions, a lot of problems. I don't believe that, say, transhumanism as a concept is never going to be possible. I just discount the predictions of these guys flogging a book.
Fair enough, but it's interesting that we're talking about technical stuff, and more and more is becoming almost obvious, but it certainly it points to the fact that biology is a software thing. It's a coded thing. It's a program thing, and the concept that a puddle of mud programmed itself to become something else is as silly as the Apple II reprogrammed itself to become the iPhone. So I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm throwing out some interesting thoughts that we don't know as much as we think we know. That's my feeling. Back to Roy.
ACTPM.
Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, just one more quick comment. Well, actually, I agree with the previous statement that we absolutely don't know what we don't know, and we definitely don't know what we think we know. It would be great if we knew a couple more things. But we've tried a lot of things genetically. We meaning me and my colleagues, not just we as a society. And, we've put a lot of different vectors into a lot of expression systems. And the funny thing is, nature finds a way to shut those things down. A lot of silencing occurs, and we've looked for ways around that, and there are very clever technologies to get around gene silencing, but that's just for literally one lentiviral vector that we've tried to introduce into one cell strain. We are so far from doing anything like adding arms that I really think it should be stated I know it's obvious, but it should be stated that that is a very, very long way off. We're talking about some of the very best people trying to do this stuff just to make one single protein in one single expression strain, such that we can study it for the best intentions, meaning solving disease states, well understood disease states. And so just to do one thing, to make one transformation, to make one protein, to study one disease is very, very difficult. To actually make an entire new organism is absolutely not happening now, and we're not becoming wolves. Sorry.
Okay, we had a quadrupled right there, so let's try again, and I'll keep my mouth closed. Yes.
Okay. It seems, although I've really enjoyed listening to everything that you guys said, it seems that we got off on the wrong foot. First of all, the Species Serum series, from what I know and what I've seen advertised, is most certainly a science fiction novel. It's not reality. It's not purporting to be reality. It brings up a couple of really interesting ideas, which is what I was bringing out when I posed my question. And I think really what kind of spun us off into a wrong direction, especially with the werewolf comments, was my not being able to finish where I was going because of my battery problems and having to go out to my car and get on the mobile to be able to continue this. The Species Serum actually mentions a book or a storyline, whatever it was, that was done online, and I spoke to the person who wrote that storyline, and it was supposedly that they had unlocked the ability to temporarily change sections of the 46 human chromosomes to be able to change the person's appearance so that they could, you know, have like a biological costume, basically. The Species Serum went quantum leap beyond that, and I'm dying to read the book. I'm dying to read what happens in it because it's talking about the evolution of a new species on Earth. But apparently, they're talking about an evolution that occurs because of changing genetics in a pre-existing organism without sex. Which is one of the problems. If you try to do the human Z experiment that they did many years ago, it failed because it prevents the human and the chimpanzee from coming together sexually. It can only be done at a chromosomal level to make it work. And even that won't last, like the previous person just said, that doesn't stay put because the cellular structure works around it to try and terminate it. It's a science fiction novel, but what I hadn't heard about the sickle cell experiment with CRISPR. What I did hear about was the Chinese geneticist who was put in jail for 3 years for modifying a pair of twin girls and taking out a full gene section and supposedly to make them immune to HIV. But it also controls brain function, higher brain function, and recovery from traumatic brain injuries. And he was punished for doing that without permission, supposedly. Again, take it with a grain of salt. It's coming from China. But that was the only thing that I had read published, and that's a couple of years old now, so that's not new. I was just wondering how many people have heard about CRISPR and the fact that you can actually move genetic sequences and change them right down to the guanine, adenine, you know, the whole nine yards, you can actually break into that. Whether we can make it work or stay put is a totally different thing, and that's why this book is in the realm of science fiction. I'll turn it back over to Ned.
Okay. CRISPR, and I'm sure there will be a lot of other techniques to manipulate gene sequences, delete, add, move them around, and what have you. And, yeah, ultimately, I think earlier someone mentioned that it's all programming, and it all is. And as Jeff mentioned, it's very difficult programming. You can knock it with a hammer and knock something loose on a good day, but to finesse building a new species requires expertise that we won't get until God knows when. If you can manipulate genetics, yes, you can change the characteristics of organisms. You can't kind of just change their genes and expect them to morph into something else, like we saw in the movie The Fly. Insects have that ability because they have rather primitive structures, and they go through regularly larval stages and adult stages that look morphologically very different. But if you've already grown up to be a human being, if you change your gene sequences, it's not going to be able to dissolve bone and regenerate it someplace else, and you'll have a wolf instead of a human being. It'll screw around with a lot of things and probably kill the organism due to the genetic non-viability of surviving in a human body that's trying to be something else. But there's a lot of science fiction related to genetics. It's all very interesting. Some of it's very scary. Just to touch back on Jim, if you read up on evolution, there's a lot of discussion of self-organizing structures. There are a lot of things that you set it up with a few simple rules, give it a few billion years, and it's capable of organizing itself into all kinds of complex, effective forms. So, you don't need an old gray-haired guy with a beard to wave a magic finger and let there be light type of things. There are rational, philosophical ways to explain how life could grow more complicated over time.
And entropy?
Entropy always increases, but it's the net entropy. Life is just another trick of the laws of thermodynamics. Our entire life ends up in a total sum increase in entropy, net. Not for ourselves. For ourselves, the entropy decreases. But at the price of increasing the net entropy in our local environment, our act of living increases entropy. But it's not a kind of a global phenomenon. Human beings can have very low decreasing entropy as long as they make up for it by increasing entropy elsewhere.
Am I to it?
Yes, Lou.
We intake, protein and fairly low entropy ordered material, and then we excrete very high entropy, equally distributed material. So we're reducing, we're expanding entropy. So entropy is increasing, but you have your little spots, but in total, it increases.
A thought to close this out, if you want.
Okay. I just want to add that Lou is quite right. Like I said before, my attitude is life is a very curious way of the universe fulfilling the laws of thermodynamics.
Fair enough. KD2VHD with this thought. It would be a fool that downloads the TikTok app to their phone, of which apparently there are many. Anybody with an inkling of brain power knows that they don't know what's going to happen when they introduce TikTok into their device. Yet we're doing that in leaps and bounds in a system far more complex in mega orders of magnitude. And I'm not so keen on that idea. Lot said in those few words, but I'll leave it at that. Back to that.
AC2GS. Well, that's understood, Jim. As I said before, unfortunately, there's the line, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. There is a lot of people on the other end who think, yes, if you can do it, you should do it, no matter what the hell it is. People were curious about if you set off thermonuclear bombs in the air, would you set the atmosphere on fire? So they did. Thankfully, it didn't set the atmosphere on fire, but they did it because they could do it, and they did it, and they're going to keep on doing things like that. There are cautions of all kinds of things. You could live safe, you could live dangerous. We probably live someplace in the middle. We're going to continue to do stupid things and not do things because we're too frightened of them. Back when they electrified factories, workers, I'm told, were very frightened and wanted hazard pay because they thought that the electricity was definitely going to kill them. So that worry was unfounded. On the other hand, you could go into a Florsheim shoe store and fluoroscope your feet from day to night, because they had fluoroscopy machines to show how the shoes fit, not considering the fact that fluoroscope rays were not very healthy. So we have exposed ourselves to a great deal of dangers. We are frightened of things that we shouldn't be, like cell towers and 5G turning us into zombies. So it's a battle back and forth, up and down, and, I mentioned earlier tonight whether we will survive it. I do not know. But the game continues. You have to take some risks, but some risks are far better than others. And wisdom is our only guidance, and there's far too many people making decisions who are not terribly wise.
Nicely said. Well done. I will say I was blessed to have lived three decades and plus of a career where hazard was at the tip of the iceberg. And you learn that, when 6 or 7 or 7, 8, 10 or 12 of people die doing that, well, maybe you want to adjust your strategy. And some of us took it seriously and some of us took it casually. I took it very seriously. But I was blessed to have gone through an experience that wasn't do I lose the game and then it goes and you die and you can go again. No, when we died. We were dead and cooked. And anyway, I'm going off on philosophical and we don't want to go there, I guess. So thanks for letting me back. Back to Roy.
Yeah, one more quick note.
Yeah, sure, please.
Just as a note, I know that some things have been said about gene editing, and other things are being said about mRNA, vaccines, but they're definitely two different things, right? But the gene editing goes back to, say, the 90s when they tried that stuff at Cornell with some kind of, with the adenovirus treatments, which had some kind of interesting results. And I won't go too far into it, but to say that the treatment was not successful. But they didn't stop there, and we didn't stop there as scientists. And as a field, we took a step back and said, that we didn't do it right, and there were bad results. There were very bad results. But why did it happen? We learned from our mistakes, and that's where the CRISPR-Cas9 system came from. And I know Jennifer Doudna. I knew her way before she was a Nobel laureate, when she was a regular scientist sitting with her team at the ThinkCon out in Chicago. People learn from their mistakes, people study things, and we make advances. AC2PL.
I agree with you, Jeff, and I think that that's appropriate. I don't think we should be like little children frightened in our crib. There are opportunities for great advances. You just have to be mindful of the risks and protect society against possible problems. A lot of things were not obvious problems. Jim mentioned that, you know, there are things that could kill you. The problem is there's a lot of things that kill you very, very slowly. And so if you're not paying attention, if you're smoking cigarettes, if you're working with asbestos, if you're working with radioactive materials, and the list goes on and on. If you're living with a lot of organic solvents, over time, a certain percentage die off. It's not as obvious as, you know, if you expose yourself to a risk and the risk kills you immediately. Those are the easy ones. It's the you know, lead in gasoline, lead in paint, all kinds of things that require decades, if not generations, to perceive the underlying risks and deal with them. So eternal vigilance, but we can't hide in the 19th century, or at least I wouldn't want to hide in the 19th century. It wasn't that much fun.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
Good thoughts. Good thoughts to consider. I'll throw this into the mix. I was lucky and unlucky enough to do a 30-plus year career where risks were the whole game. And risks to your literally your skin were regular occurrence. And that was important. But it was exponentially more important to me, the risk that I was exposing to people that were working for me in that environment. And the caution level was exponentially higher as a result. And then the topic we're discussing today involves the situation of the exponential risk to everybody, literally everybody, all of us human beings on the planet. Well, let's try to see what happens. Sounds stupid. Back to that.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of things are global problems that you have to learn to deal with, and they aren't immediately obvious to everyone. And then there are strange people out there who don't really, for some odd reason, don't care about the risks if it means they could make a whole lot of money before they die. So, again, we've kind of noticed that type of behavior probably in the last 10, 15, 20 years. These guys who you just say, you know, blow the place up after I'm done. I'm not going to need this world anyway. And other people who are trying to run away to Mars and such to survive the other guys were willing to blow the place up. So, you know, I wish us all great luck. As I mentioned earlier, I have my doubts whether humanity will survive. There's a lot of literature that's been written whether a civilization kind of is a self-defeating biological evolution, that's an end point. When a species becomes clever enough to kill themselves, they may end up killing themselves, which is not a good evolutionary trend. So evolution might have taken the wrong turn when he turned us into very smart apes. Time will tell. We'll all be gone long before anyone will know the answer to many of the questions that we have posed tonight.
I say that I enjoy this stuff, and I am disgusted every time at some family gathering. You can't say that. Don't talk about that. Or a ham radio thing. You can't talk about that. This is a radio. I enjoy this. I think others do. It's a wonderful thing. Thank you for making it happen.
A2EMP.
Yes, Bill.
I want to echo and support what he just said. I have never had more fun talking on the net. All of the subjects were fantastic. It makes me think, and the talk is so fast sometimes that I just can't even keep up with all the things that I wanted to ask or say or bring out. But, yeah, let's see if we survive. And like I said, this is definitely a science fiction book. And it's, from what I was told, it's not about werewolves per se. It's about where the werewolf tales may have originated from. That's all I know, and nobody's telling me any much more than that. The book drops tomorrow, so I'm definitely going to go get a copy and read it, and I'll find out. But it sounds really interesting to me. That's why I brought it up. And I really appreciate all of you guys tonight. It was fantastic. But I'm going to turn off my car and stop polluting the atmosphere, and I am going to sign off and go inside. Have a nice night. This is K2EMT, and I'll be out.
Okay, very good, Bill. Thank you for that question, and thank you for your participation. Again, my guesstimate of what the ideology is the occasional mutation where guys and women, too, probably, end up having excessive hair growth throughout their body. I think there were some brothers from Mexico who unfortunately ended up doing a freak show. I think they're the ideology for the concept of human beings that are part wolf, but who knows? Anyway, thanks to everyone. Thanks for the compliments. I do hope that you appreciated it and weren't either bored or annoyed. You know, every so often there's guys out there who are saying, for God's sake, talk about antennas. And we try to. We try to talk about everything and anything. So I thank you all for your participation. I do wish that you'll come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. Now it's time for Paul WS2N with the Space Net.
Thanks, Roy. AC2GS WS2N. And if you have nothing to do, go on the internet and look up an old song, 2525, in the year 2525. That sounds like this guy predicted what we were talking about here to some degree. Let me drop it. Okay, great topics, I agree, all night long. Now, as far as the SpaceNet report goes, it is three lunar landings coming up very shortly, probably at the end of January. But to get there, you know, they have to launch. There's one that launched already, and that was called SLIM, Smart Lander for Investigation of the Moon. And that was launched back in September on a Japanese rocket. You know, they have their own rockets, the H-2A rocket. And it successfully got up to and around the moon. Actually, it's one of these orbits that they went like hundreds of thousands of miles past the moon, and then eventually start coming back. But eventually, toward the middle or end of January, they plan on landing this thing on the moon. If they do it, it'll be what, the fifth country to be able to actually land a vehicle successfully. Now there's two other ones that are going up that have nothing to do with Japan. And one of them is called Intuitive Machines. And they're launching very shortly on a Falcon rocket. I think it's the second week of January. And it's called the Nova C Lander. And again, that's scheduled to land on the moon around January 19th to the 21st. So we'll see how if that one is successful. I'm hoping it is. That has an interesting camera on board attached to it. Right before it lands, a couple hundred feet above the surface of the moon, this camera's got to detach from the lander and fly away. And it's got four cameras on it, so no matter which direction it's facing, it'll be taking pictures. So if that successfully gets transmitted back down to Earth, you'll actually be able to see the Nova the lander land on the moon, because I have this additional camera called the Eagle camera that that will be able to take pictures. So that would be pretty cool. So we got a real moon race going on here. There's another one coming up called Astrobiotic. Is the name of the company that's launching the Peregrine Lunar Lander, another American company. And actually, I was scheduled to launch Christmas Eve, but just tonight they have delayed it to the beginning of January. This is a spacecraft that's going to be launched on the Vulcan rocket, the brand new Vulcan rocket that United Launch Alliance has been developing for the last probably 12 years or so. And it's behind in schedule. It should have gone up a couple of years ago. But now they are to the point where they can get their inaugural launch. It looks like the very beginning of January now. It was going to go up Christmas Eve, but the ULA had... what they did is they usually run a wet dress rehearsal, they call it. When you get a new rocket, especially, you put it on the launch bed and you fill up the fuel and the oxygen. In this case, it's a methane system, liquid oxygen. And you do the same to the second stage, and you actually do a countdown. You come right down to right before ignition, and they just undo that. And if everything goes well, then they reset, and eventually they will launch a couple of few days later. They ran that wet dress rehearsal, and there was some ground issues, nothing to do with the rocket, ground issues at the Cape that creeped up, and they're just going to iron that out, run it through another wet dress rehearsal, and then hopefully Peregrine gets to launch sometime early in January. Yeah, Peregrine lander was actually tested for vibration and problems that it might have right here on Long Island, not too far from where I live. I'm in Rock Hockama. They tested it over in Bohemia. And these are good-sized landers, although the one by Japan is on the small side. But the Peregrine and the Novosphere are pretty hefty. And the idea is if they become successful in landing, there's already plans on a Nova C2 and 3 and the same for Peregrine. There's going to be future launches, for 2024. If they're successful, NASA naturally will sign more contracts with these people, and they will contract them to deliver supplies, to the... mostly to the South Pole, because that's where the eventual landing of Artemis 3 is supposed to take place. Although I don't see that happening. They wanted to land in 2024. I don't see that landing until maybe 2025. Maybe late 2025, maybe early 2026 at best. Because SpaceX is way behind in their program. SpaceX is part of the NASA Lunar Landing Program. They have the contract to take astronauts from orbit around the moon down to the surface, back up to the Earth, orbit around the moon, and they're way behind in that schedule. And Blue Origin also has their own lander that they're developing, but they're not behind schedule. They're just scheduled to start doing this probably in 2027 and 2028. But that's NASA's system of you need at least two companies, completely different companies, preferably. To do something. In case one thing fails, they always have the other one. And eventually, the one that fails eventually catches up, hopefully. Any comments? WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
2BHD.
Yes, Jim, go ahead. How you doing?
Good. Interesting stuff. I was just going to nudge that you make some address to the interesting launch that's coming up of the this weird military secret vehicle that's getting launched on Amazon, not Amazon, but SpaceX Falcon Heavy. I'm out of my realm here, but you know, I think you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay, very good. Yeah, yeah. You're right on. You're right on, Jim. That's scheduled to go off. Actually, it was supposed to go off tonight, right at the beginning of the net. 8:15, it was going to go off. But again, I think yesterday or Saturday, they decided to delay it a day. So it looks like tomorrow. And that's because of this weather front that we have. You know, right now I have heavy rain, heavy wind here. Well, that front goes all the way down to Florida, you know. And so they did cancel it. And they do have to recover the boosters. It's really not all that bad. The weather is not all that bad in Merritt Island, where they launch these things from. But they do recover the boosters at sea. And although the center booster in this case, they will not recover. And yeah, you're talking about the X-37B. Looks like a shuttle, you know, maybe 25% the size of the old shuttle. And that's been launching since, there's two of them that they built. When I say they, Boeing built for, not for NASA, but for the Defense Department. You know, and the National Reconnaissance Office uses the X-37B. So these two vehicles have the capability of launching on a rocket inside of a fairing, and they go into orbit, and they stay up there for, well, in the beginning it was months, and now it actually, they stay up for over a year. The last one that just went up stayed up over 900 days. They have the capability of re-entering the atmosphere when they're done with their project. And they've landed so far on two different runways. One, they have a 3-mile runway out in Vandenberg Air Force, California. They have out in Mojave, they have the landing facility. And then lately they've been landing on the 3-mile runway that the shuttle used to use in Florida. And of course these things are unmanned, but they have all kinds of equipment on board, probably a lot of spy stuff. Again, this is not NASA, this is the Defense Department. They do have a cargo bay. The cargo bay pops open when they're up there, and they have a solar array that comes out. They have experiments that are exposed. They have done some experiments for NASA. You know, they put materials in space, materials that they want to test in the open cargo bay. This flight here, I think they're putting seeds on board, on some kind of seeds they want to test over the next year or two, however long this thing's going to be in space before it comes back. One of the things that these latest X-37Bs have are the Hall thrusters. Hall thrusters are ion thrusters, so you need a bunch of electricity to run it, and which they have. They have the solar panels that after the cargo bay is open, and that supplies power to the Hall thrusters. And they're able to maneuver. They can go from, like, one area of space to another area of space. You know, not too good a change in inclination. That's not that easy. But they can maneuver. Maybe they can creep up on a spy sat on another satellite from China or something and look at it. Anyway, they always go to a low Earth orbit, usually 300 some odd miles above the surface of the Earth. And they, in the past, now this is the seventh one that's going to be launched, but in the past, the other ones that have launched have gone up on an Atlas rocket. You know, they use the Atlas V rocket. And then the other one that, one other time they did use a Falcon 9 rocket to do that. But that's to put it into relatively low Earth orbit, a miles or so up above the surface of the Earth. But this one, like you said, Jim, they're putting it on a Heavy, a Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy is nothing but three Falcon boosters bolted together. It still has a second. It still has an upper stage on it as well, of course. And they have this, 17-foot diameter fairing that they put the whole space plane inside of it. And then the thing launches that way. Now, what they said, why are they using the Falcon Heavy? And naturally, nobody confirms this, but, you know, it's assumed that this thing is going to be putting it into a very high orbit, maybe even a geosynchronous orbit. Don't know yet, but that it'll go out to, could go out to that 23,000 miles above the Earth. And if it does, what's it going to be doing out there? Again, with the Hall thrusters on it, maybe it'll be investigating a satellite or two.
Thought?
Over time. And my guess, the last one was 900 days. This one's probably going to do the same thing, or more. So maybe you know, a couple of years from now, this thing will eventually return back into the atmosphere. Unless they have a special purpose for going up as high as they are. You know, maybe they are going to investigate a satellite, maybe one of our own. You know, that might have a problem that they want to look at it. And then maybe they will try to return it. Not that easy to return something from geosynchronous orbit. You know, orbital mechanics, it takes a lot of fuel to do that, a real lot of fuel. So if that's what they plan on doing, the Hall effect thrusters, the ion thrusters, could help them accomplish that.
A couple thoughts?
You have it, Jim. Go ahead.
It's interesting that the Hall effect thrusters that you described, which I'm not familiar with, I've heard that term before, sounded awful lot like impulse power. Very interesting. And the fact that this thing is going up on a Falcon Heavy, is there anything heavy that has been talked about being brought up into space that could do something because it's heavy? Wink, wink. Back to you.
You're probably right. Oh, yeah. We'll see. Yeah, this thing, the Falcon Heavy puts out over 5 million pounds of thrust, very similar to what the shuttle put out. So you could bring up a lot of weight, you know. Although, I don't think they're going to have any additional satellites on this flight, which, you know, a lot of times they do. Because this thing really does take up the whole inside of the fairing before it launches. But, you know, you could be right. There could be something else also in there. Yeah, they're ion thrusters. And there's basically two different types. And this one is a little bit more powerful than the original ones that NASA used to use. And, they sent ion thrusters on the Dawn mission, which eventually went into orbit around Vista and then the other asteroid, Cirrus. It actually orbited both, and they have that capability, again, because you get so much, it takes forever for, you know, to accelerate or de-accelerate with these things, but they're on all the time, so eventually they do manage to do that, and because of that, they were able to put Dawn into orbit around Vista, eventually de-orbited that with the ion thrusters, and again, went into orbit around Cirrus. I think today it's still in orbit around that Cirrus. But, yeah, they work by, you know, really electricity. You know, it's it's like one big, I don't know, I consider it like a big electron gun. You know, you take you have an anode and a cathode, and you're shooting it off the cathode and it's heading to the anode near the front of the rocket engine. And then at the back of the rocket engine, they release xenon gas. They bring it, that's the fuel, the xenon gas, which xenon, if you look at the atomic number, it's on the heavy side. It's not, you know, which makes it great, because once the xenon gets ionized from these electrons that are nano to the cathode, they become ionized, and now all you have to do is find a way to push these heavy protons out of the back of the rocket. The way to do that is with the magnetic field that's also surrounding me, you know, on this in this rocket, and that gives them their thrust. And they say if you were in space and you saw the thing, it would be giving off like a blue light, you know, coming out of the back of it. So it's really, really pretty cool. Back to you, Jim. WSLAN.
Thank you for the insight. Go on.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, relationship to chemical fuels, I think, is, you know, like at least 10 to 1. You know, you just don't, you can't compare it. We'll see. We'll see how X-37B, that's what they call it, does. And, you know, I followed it on and off for years. And, you know, everybody talked about the, you know, over the last couple of years with NASA, they're talking about it, putting up Dream Chaser. Dream Chaser is a vehicle being built by Sierra Nevada, and that's going to be a space plane as well. It's the same idea. It's going to be encapsulated in a fairing, launch into space. Eventually, we'll be able to dock with the International Space Station. Dream Chaser doesn't have a cargo bay that opens up, but it's got a lot of room inside. It will be able to bring the most cargo to the space station out of all the different cargo vehicles that go down on a regular basis. So we'll see how that thing goes. That's supposed to launch. I talked about the Vulcan going up. When the Vulcan goes up, that's actually launching the, which was supposed to be December. Now it's going to be January. That's launching the astrobiotic, the Peregrine lander. Now, that's the inaugural flight. I mean, that's how confident NASA and Boeing is that they're launching the first flight to the moon. Not kind of like that. You know, SpaceX, they wouldn't do that. They launch it. If it blows up, we'll fix it and blow up another one and so on and so forth. ULA does not do that. United Launch Alliance, they pretty much want everything perfect. They test everything, every little piece before they put it together on a launch pad. Okay, let me just finish my thought there. So, but that's what they have planned now for the they plan on using the Vulcan rocket for the, that will be the next flight. So a month or two or three, whatever it is, probably April, my guess is the next flight of Vulcan. They'll be launching the Dream Chaser. The other station I heard, go ahead, this is Paul, WS2N.
WS2N, NV2T, just a quickie, listening to the conversations. What about the program where they're going to put the receiver, I think, on the backside of the moon? Is that going to go up with which rocket, NV2T, Jim?
They're going to put a, I'm trying to think now, they're going to put a receiver on the back of the rocket. I'm not sure. Is this a lunar mission that you're discussing?
Yeah, I heard that, you know, there's a mission called Lucy, L-U-C-E-E, where they put a receiver on the backside of the moon, and it's supposed to look back in time because there's no noise apparently back there. So they can look back almost to the Big Bang, you know, during the dark ages there, where there's just the helium and the hydrogen. But I was wondering how they're getting it up there. but you guys seem to know all that stuff, so I figured I'd just drop in, you know.
I want to look into when that's planned. But, you know, they planned that, I remember 10 years ago, that scientists wanted that. But I haven't heard any updates lately. I think you were saying Lucy. There's a Lucy flight presently in flight, and that's on the way to the L4 and the L5 Trojan orbits of Jupiter. They're going to pick up the asteroids in those locations many years from now, I think 2029. But that's on its way. That was very successful. Even so, they had problems with one of their solar panels. These things are big. I mean, I know I'm not answering your question, but the Lucy that I'm talking about has two 25-foot diameter solar panels. So, you know, they need them that big because all the way out in Jupiter orbit, you know, you're only going to get, like they said, around 800 watts of power to run this thing. So, you know, although if it was in Earth orbit, you have like 25 watts of power. But, I we'll look into that. The Lucy mission that you're talking about, is that going to be a lander, or is that going to be something that they plan on just, you know, orbiting the moon with?
No, it's a lander, and that's why I was interested, because I worked at Grumman back during the lunar lander days, and this thing looks identical to it, you know, the way the quadrupod legs are and all that stuff, you know, and it's got a bunch of dipoles sticking out of the top and solar panels, and they're going to land it on the backside of the moon, and it's called the Lunar Surface Electromagnetic Experiment, LUCEE. Supposedly they're going to land it, but I'm wondering how they were going to get it there, so that's all. But I'll do a little more research, and I can contribute on the next get-together. But they're going to, you know, land on the far side of the moon, which is kind of interesting, you know. And, you know, that whole project is, you know, unmanned, of course, but, you know, it's going to be a receiver sitting down there with a bunch of dipoles looking out into space, you know. All right, keep continue on. I'm enjoying NV2T. Thanks for letting me pop in.
Yeah, I'll definitely look into how far along they are on that. I haven't read anything about that in the last, I'd say, year or so. So, that's, you know, we have plans of, a lot of plans of landing on the moon. Like, these three missions will all be in January, but there's more plans for the rest of the year. And I haven't read that is one of them. I haven't heard that at all. And the only ones that I know that so far have done it for sure is China. They landed on the far side of the moon. And, you know, that's interesting. As far as communications go, China needed spacecraft that was out, you know, far distant orbit to do that, and they put that into like an L2 position where it would kind of like stay there. So when that thing landed on the backside of the moon, they had communications with it, you know, for the whole time. You know, the land had transmitted up to the satellite, like, worked like a repeater, and they transmitted it back to China. So I would suspect we'd have to do the same thing. As far as I know, we don't have anything like that. We have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is constantly orbiting the moon since 2009. I guess that would have the capability of doing some of that work if they had to. But very good. We'll look into it. Thanks for that. We'll definitely look into that. This is
Any other comments?
Yeah, WB2BX.
Yeah, Frank, very good. How you doing this evening? WB2BXL, Frank. WS2N.
WB2BXL here. Am I coming to Echo Link?
Yes, you are. But I went back to you, then you did not come back to me. So, but this time, you know, if you sound good, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I may have peaked just too quickly last time. I don't know whether there's still currently a plan for the U.S. or the U.S. and ESA to put a radio telescope on the backside of the moon. I know there have been a bunch of proposals to do some other sophisticated one. The Chinese, as I understand it, did try to do that with their lander. They did put an HF receiver up there to try to listen without all the HF noise. Since on the backside of the moon, they'd be blocked from all the HF transmissions on Earth and could listen to what's coming from the rest of the cosmos. And they had an RFI problem with that, as I understand it. They had RFI from the solar panel, so they and the noise level was much too high to do what they wanted. I think any ham could have told them that they were going to have a problem with that. But, you know, maybe there weren't any, maybe there's something I don't understand about what went wrong, or maybe they just didn't have any hands on the project. And I don't recall which mission it was, you probably do, where they flew a 28 megahertz receiver on the mission going out to Jupiter and tested it by having the hams transmitted to it on 10 meters. Transmit HI in QRSS, you know, very slow morph, and then had it relay the transmissions back. And I didn't think that would work, but it actually did. I know the audio is available on the internet for that one. Go ahead.
Yeah, they wanted to test out the plasma receiver. On it goes down, I guess, 10 million miles out, you know, on its way to eventually get to Jupiter. That was cool. That's called Juno. Juno is still presently in the polar orbit around that planet. And I was one of the people that got involved in that, Frank. What happened was they needed hams to transmit at the exact same time. It didn't matter what side of the Earth you were or on at the time. They didn't care. They just wanted everybody to key down at the exact same moment. So, you know, that's what we did. It was just all dots, no dashes. But, you know, you would, they tell you on the internet how long to hold it for and release, how long to hold it for and release, that type of thing. Then they were going to release the information like months later of whether or not it was successful, and they did. And then they said, anybody that was involved in this, you know, we will send you, a QSL card. And that took like a year. And there was another person here, AC2LR, she did it as well. And we both got the cards. And it had, I guess it was a little over a year later in the mail. And that took place in 2013, Frank, back to you.
Yeah, I remember hearing the audio clip. That was kind of cool. Yeah, that's that's kind of a hoot. And yeah, I did kind of get thought it was kind of funny or vain that the Chinese had a problem with putting their HF receiver on the backside of the moon, that they had too much RFI to hear anything. It was like.